We have another Soundtrack in Live for you this week, recorded at the Glasgow Film Festival back in February, I think, before lockdown came into effect. Man, that feels like a lifetime ago already. My guests were Simon Bird and Stuart Murdoch, discussing their collaboration on Simon's gorgeous directorial debut, Days of the Bagnold Summer, for which Belle and Sebastian provided the music. Starring Monica Dolan and Earl Cave, son of Nick, Days of the Bagnold Summer is based on a graphic novel by Geoff Winterhart and tells the story of a single mother and her 15-year-old son as they navigate the stresses and strains of a school summer holiday in each other's company. Note to self, I have that just around the corner. It's a beautiful piece of work and you can watch it now on home entertainment formats, and I highly recommend that you do. Belle and Sebastian's music, meanwhile, is available via Matador Records, and we'll be hearing a little bit of that shortly. But first, a word from our friends at Gymshark. Now, Gymshark is not only a conditioning brand dedicated to creating functional training wear, but also really strives to build passionate, empowered communities. They formed back in 2012 in a garage in Birmingham and now connect with a worldwide family of over 15 million people in over 150 countries. In these times of isolation, I'm finding it more and more important than ever to try and get some exercise. It's good for me physically, but also, more importantly, mentally. I've been trying to do a couple of runs every week, conditioning my mind and body with a little bit of yoga, and then also doing PE classes with the kids, or at least attempting to, from tennis to cricket and athletics. I find motivation to do my best can come from wearing comfortable, empowering clothing. That's why I'm a huge fan of Gymshark and their brand. It does get me motivated and ready to push myself that little bit further. For more information and to check out the range, head to gymshark.com/Edith Bowman. That's gymshark.com/Edith Bowman. And so to Simon and Stuart. As we'll hear, Belle and Sebastian furnished Simon with loads and loads of music, some of which had lyrics, some of which did not, instead serving as more traditional instrumental score. We'll begin with one such cue, Sister Buddha. Brought your beers out. I should have brought mine. Ah, never mind. I'll go and get it. No. Sit yourself down. Now, you both should have a microphone there as well. Thank you for bringing clips and for just, you know, putting a bit of work in for us today as well. I've seen the film, and Simon, I've got to say congratulations, because I think it's a really beautiful film, and being a mum as well of a kid who's preteen, it kind of also terrifies
a horror film. Yeah.
But do you mind talking about how long, you know, you've been wanting to make a film and making that step into directing, and how easy or difficult that journey was for you?
Yeah, I guess it's something I wanted to do for ages. I mean, I'm obviously more famous as an actor, but, you know, as much as I love acting, it's creatively not the most fulfilling thing you can do, because they're not your words and you don't really have any say over how it turns out. So I knew I wanted to do something where I could take back control. That's one of my main mottos, actually, for life.
T-shirts are available in the foyer after.
Yeah, I wanted to do something where I could basically see a project through all the way from the beginning to the end. Mm. I made a short film first, and then started thinking about a feature. And this book that I'd read a few years ago really just kept coming back to it. Mm. And the graphic novel that the film is based on is by a guy called Geoff Winterhart. And it's just this incredibly beautiful, poignant, funny, short, crucially, book. And that it felt like a story that I hadn't really seen in a British film before. So yeah, that's how I ended up with this.
What's the first day on set like when you're directing for the first time?
Well, I mean, it's a bit scary, but I think I've been lucky in that I've worked on a lot of sets before. Mm-hmm. And also I do quite a lot. I'm a bit of a boffin, and I was sort of ready. I think I was so scared in advance that I'd done so much preparation that by the time we were there, I sort of knew what exactly how the day was going to pan out.
Yeah.
So actually, it was fine. Anticlimactic answer. It was absolutely fine, actually.
Inside, shitting myself. But what about when it came to music for the film, and what point did you start thinking about how the film would sound?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously like a huge part of the book and then the script that Lisa wrote, because so for anyone who doesn't know, the film is about a boy who is a huge metalhead. He loves Metallica and Iron Maiden and Judas Priest, and that's a big part of the story. And equally, then it's a big part that you see what his mum's taste is, which is more sort of 70s MOR. James Taylor and Barry Manilow.
I love that scene of her singing in the car.
Yeah, it's so great.
Good.
So I definitely knew music was going to be an important part of it, but I was quickly informed as well that we would never get any of those bands that I've just mentioned.
Someone said that to you then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, straight away. So we sort of had to think again. And so I went through various thought processes. I mean, at one stage, we were talking about the film being totally different and being more in the aesthetic of the book, which is black and white. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about doing it in black and white and making it quite sort of grungy and having a purely metal soundtrack. And that didn't feel right because it's, metal is Daniel's passion, but it's not Sue's, and it's mm-hmm. just as much Sue's story as it is Daniel's. So I sort of decided we needed something to thread it all together. I don't know, the sort of weird theory I settled on in my head was that the music should in some way sort of match what I think Joff's drawings do in the book. I think the drawings, straight away, from the first panel that you see in the book, that there's a real empathy there, and the drawings are sort of witty without being cruel, and they're sort of human. And immediately that there's a sort of warmth to it.
Yeah.
So that's what I was thinking about with the music. And obviously, with all those adjectives I said, the first thing I thought of was Ben Sebastian, which were, it was weird sitting next to Stuart and saying this, but like that there was such a formative influence on me when I was a teenager. I think I first heard them when I was sort of 15 or whatever, and really getting into music, and it was sort of during Britpop, and it was the first music I'd heard that just really chimed with me and was like introspective and not as laddie as some of the other some of the Britpop bands that were around.
It's good storytelling and songwriting, isn't
exactly
it?
Yeah, kind of... and just sort of witty and and wise. So yeah, I mean, so I thought Ben Sebastian, I think I said to the music supervisor that we had on the film, that type of music, obviously we're not going to get Ben Sebastian, but that sort of thing, can you go and tell me who we can afford that would do, a pale imitation? And he sort of secretly sent the book and the script to Stuart, and a week later, Stuart got in touch and was sort of immediately up for it.
Amazing.
It was crazy. But yeah, that was sort of a very strange, surreal moment.
Were you aware of the book beforehand, Stuart?
No, my friend liked it and she had mentioned it, but when I first got it, that was the first time I'd really seen it.
What was your reaction when you read the script then?
Well, I didn't read the script first. I read the book.
Yeah.
The stage when they mentioned the project, I got the, I bought it that night online and read it immediately, and just thought, let's do this. This is ideal. In the same way that the picture suggested a certain sound to you, I almost felt that I could hear that sound as well, coming off the, so it just felt like the right thing to do.
What do you think it was you connected with the story?
Oh, it had a certain vibe, there's I think almost like a little bit Adrian Mole, or in between Adrian Mole and Mike Lee, these are two kind of things I love, for instance, so it just immediately, it just got me straight away. It's just the tone, you could look at the first panel and you'd be like, I know I'm going to enjoy this. Yeah. I do like a comic novel, not the kind of, you know, not so much the kind of Marvel stuff, but I like certain comic novels and I tend to like this one.
They almost give space, don't they, for an interpretation in a way. So if you are thinking about it in a filmic way or a musical way and stuff, there's almost kind of space in the way that they're created to allow your imagination to take it a step further in a way, is the thing I always think with graphic novels in particular.
Yeah, totally. I think especially with this one, it feels like a very untraditional graphic novel. It feels like almost a graphic novel for like middle-aged mums.
That's me.
Yeah, well, and weirdly me, it turns out. But definitely, I mean, that was what was nice about it. I mean, I knew that I loved the book, but it also felt like there was a lot to do with it creatively. Because as much as you sort of finish the book, sort of totally getting it, actually when you look back, nothing's happened and there's very little dialogue in it, so it still is a challenge to make a film out of it.
It was a
fun challenge.
And so what constitutes...
I wonder what... You didn't ask Judas Priest, did you? I'm just curious.
I don't think we went to Judas Priest. No, we did. We definitely asked Metallica, right? And actually Metallica were very nice and let us use a lot of their t-shirts.
See that again?
Metallica let us use a lot of their t-shirts, but the music was more expensive.
I just wondered what they would have made of it, you know, passing it around the kind of band room and like, I do like this one. I like sorry, from Birmingham, aren't they, Judas Priest?
Can you do Brum? No, not that one. And then, but what were the conversations then that you had with regards to how you would approach providing music for the film? Was it always going to be... You know, because there's moments where it's just melody that's used. There are moments where it's song, you know, and lyrics are in there as well. It's a really lovely mix of things. And so what were the discussions that you had about what you needed and what you wanted?
We spoke quite early about it before we started filming, which I think was really useful. I think in the back of my head, what I sort of knew what I wanted to avoid was sort of that thing of composing for a moment in the film, or, you know, like sending a scene and being like, we just want this to be more emotional.
So put some
music on it. So I sort of wanted to avoid any of that hand-holding stuff. I don't know. I thought these guys would send us one or two little bits of melody that we'd then thread throughout the film. What actually happened is they sent me like many albums worth of brilliant material.
Wow.
And I was like totally sport for choice. And in the end, just wanted to put as much of it in as possible. We had a sort of conversation where we talked about films that we
like. Yeah, did you have any reference points and stuff?
I think Harold and Maude was one of mine.
Cat Stevens one. I love that.
Which
film
is a lovely one. And
We spoke about that and The Graduate, I think. Oh, yeah. And a lot of sort of stuff from the... 70s, 60s. I just couldn't believe how generous Stuart was with their music. It was ridiculous. I was like, really? I felt like such a fanboy.
For me.
Yeah, I got just sort of sent a Dropbox folder with like 30 new Belle and Sebastian songs.
Oh my God.
Well, the thing is, the band is, we're all getting older, and we sort of feel like how long do we have? You know, life is short, you know, and so we're trying to write, we're trying to make more and more music faster and faster because we have a lot of ideas. Mm. So it really wasn't extra generous of us, really. It was just like, we were like,
okay, I take that back.
What a role.
We were just really happy to, and we were working on a kind of an instrumental project anyway. We were sort of doing so it was a nice spur, and the key thing is to get in early. Yeah. In any collaborative process is to get in early, because we did one film project like 10 years or 12 years before that, and we came in sort of afterwards, and we had none of the joy of collaboration, really.
But is it a different experience for you, though, as a band, when it's a project for someone else? You're still as the band, but is the pressure off? You know, it's not kind of like you need to provide an album. So, yeah, what are you...
Yeah, it's slightly different kind of thing. I think you just have fun, and also because you get a lot of inspiration from the material and from the people you're working with. So it tends to go quite quickly. And are any of the band here? No, it's like
awkward.
It would kill them to show up, but it would, no, okay, they see enough of me during the week. But it's they really warm to this sort of thing, you know, because I write a lot of words, obviously, and then in projects like this is more strictly instrumental music, and they all write pure music, so they're usually more involved in that kind of project, so they really like it.
I'm gonna play a clip. And then we'll talk about it after this.
Daniel, are you okay?
I'm fine.
Don't fall asleep in there.
Now I'm in kind of similar trouble. Same old fear, just a different place. Taxi take me to somewhere exotic. Taxi show me the look on the face of boy. To the way you are feeling now. Wait and see what the day holds. Feeling now. See what the day holds.
So good. And it's I love how we have this absolute luxury of, you know, you think there's a bit of score coming in over this, and then suddenly we hear your beautiful voice and these lyrics and stuff that so complement the story as well. And sure, what were you know when you're writing the lyrics to a piece of music that is, it's a piece of score, but it's more than that. How are you addressing that? How are you starting that?
Again, we had the luxury of coming in early. So we very quickly wrote, inspired by the script, inspired by what we talked about. So that one, for instance, it's coming from you, but it's being inflected by the film. So if it works in the scene, then that's because of the filmmaking and the editing, you know. So it wasn't really, I don't think, I mean, yes. That wasn't written for that.
So for that, wouldn't have been written for that particular bit.
Yeah.
But like I say, they sent me so much stuff that was like, that I had bit for, you know, for any scene that we had.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, that bit works perfectly there. And yeah. This bit is great for that.
So you hadn't seen any performances or anything at this point as well?
No, I don't think so.
You sent me all that music before we started filming.
We pretty much, that's what I mean. We'd written a lot, but you kind of have that, you have the confidence that when you've done it a couple of times before, if you're in that zone, then you know it's gonna hopefully work.
That's extraordinary, because not many composers get that luxury of that early start. You know, in terms of your literally the pictures, what do they call it, locked, where it's all, you know, where it's edited and that's it, and then they've got to write to that time, to that beat, to that sort of thing.
That's what we knew and realized, and that's why we wanted to get in early, not just because we're lazy, but
the sounds of things, you're anything but lazy.
No, but it's the thing is that you probably would have to do 10 times the work to do that kind of stuff, you know, to do that Craig Armstrong stuff, and we just don't have the the discipline to, you know, there's seven of us and it's a mess, you know. So it's much more fun to do it that way, our way.
What was your reaction when you saw the choices that Simon had then made from what you'd provided, you know, married with those performances as well, with those songs?
Oh, it's all good. Yeah, I loved it. I mean, the performances are so great, you know, and
they so fit as well.
Yeah,
that's the kind of great thing. It's like this wonderful sort of almost like serendipity of these, without seeing the performances, how well the music fits them.
Sure, but you know, Simon got the tone right in the movie, which is the important thing.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah.
Did you play any of the cast, any of the music?
No, I don't think I did. No, I at that stage I was very busy. no, I think they were listening to a lot more stuff that was, you know, so I think Earl was desperately trying and failing to get into heavy metal. But he did give it a good old go.
Yeah.
But he just doesn't like it.
Does he not?
No.
What does he like?
You know, cool stuff.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. The son of Nick Cave has got to be just like, you know.
So no, I think they were listening to more sort of character stuff.
I like the idea that, did Monica do the same? Did they have little playlists for their car?
They did, yeah. They used to share a car in to film in. I think they took it in turns to play each other's CDs. So yeah, they were swapping Metallica and James Taylor, I think, on a loop.
Was there, in the song she sings in the car?
Yeah.
Was that in the script?
Well, yeah, it sort of had to be. That had a sort of checkered history of, in the book or in the first draft of the screenplay, it was Dancing Queen, and my producer just sort of burst out laughing. It was like, absolutely not. So then we started to look for like songs that everyone knows that are free. And once we were looking at like Green Sleeves, I was like, this isn't right. So we basically had to find something that was cheap, but for anyone who hasn't seen it, which is basically everyone.
Quite a few, actually.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah, thank you. There is a scene where Sue and Daniel go on a sort of road trip, and she is singing one of her favourite songs in the car. And in the film, it's Can't Smile Without You.
You know I can't smile without you. I can't smile without you. I can't laugh and I can't sing. I'm finding it hard to do anything. You see, I feel sad when you're sad. I feel glad when you're glad. You only knew what I'm going through. I just can't smile without you.
And that was like basically the cheapest song we could find.
Such a good song as well.
Well, yeah, but then it sort of morphs into the actual recording of Can't Smile Without You, which we were going to go into the Barry Manilow one, which was, I think, like, I don't know whether we should talk about numbers.
But everyone does. It's
okay,
great.
It was £6,000.
Wow. Well.
So instead, Stuart and Banners Bastion did it for free. So thank you. Thank you.
You did a great version. I like yours better. We've got another brilliant clip, which is going to work seamlessly now since we sorted out all the technical stuff.
Oh, get me away from here, I'm dying. Play me a song to set me free. Nobody writes them like they used to, so it may as well be me. Here am I now after hours. Here am I now on a bus. Think of it this way, you could either be successful or be us. Without winning smiles and us, without catchy tunes or words. Now we're photogenic, you know, we don't stand a chance.
Anything else?
Cheeseburger, fries and a Coke.
Wanna go large for 60p?
Yeah, right.
He's so good in this film.
Good, isn't he?
he's so good, and it's kind of when I see his name attached to anything or he's in it, I was like, I've got to watch it because he's just got this charisma. So kind of, you know, I mean, that's probably not a good example of his charisma on the screen, but he's just extraordinary to watch.
He's amazing, yeah. It's such a hard part to cast because, you know, he's basically like a grumpy teenager, but you've got to, the audience have got to be rooting for him on some level, and he's got to be likable despite the fact he basically spends the whole film swearing at his mum. We saw so many kids.
Did you?
Yeah. But Earl was just, he was just, something about him is magnetic, and he's just such, he's just so nice. He's such a lovely, lovely man. And that just shines through even when he's, you know, playing a little bastard.
Was that a weird thing for you, kind of being on the other side, you know, being an actor and having to screen test people and choose someone for your film?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, I've sort of done that before. Like, I've made sitcoms before and been in on those casting sessions and cast my own live shows. So I've sort of done it before and was just, you know, knew the book and the scripts so well and inside out that I just knew exactly what we were looking for.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, this sort of the second he walked in, we knew it was him.
But that scene is like, it's almost like a little mini silent movie in a way, and the song does so much to kind of, it's so funny as well, the choices of, you know, the establishments that he goes into to hand in his CV is just...
That song is an interesting point, really. I mean, because I was quite keen not to have that in the film, frankly, just because it's a classic Belle and Sebastian song and I want it to be all new material. But our editor put it on like the first cut that he did. So I didn't ever choose that. The editor put it on because he knew Belle and Sebastian were soundtracking the film.
Yeah.
And I watched it and I just knew straight away it was perfect. And I was really pissed off. I was like, I'm never going to be able to take that off.
Did you try anything else?
We tried some of the other amazing material they had, but something about that and the, you know, it ends on that lyric about the, you know, a boy just like me. Mm-hmm. And just, it was annoying.
What was your reaction to that, Stuart, after you provided all this new music?
No, I don't mind. We even re-recorded it. The song, because it's kind of a little bit difficult for me to listen back to. You know, that's a long time ago. So we did a and it's on the album, on the soundtrack album, but you definitely fitted, it worked for you, the old version.
Yeah. Sorry.
No. It was just an afternoon's work.
Oh, get me away from here, I'm dying. Play me a song to set me free. Nobody writes them like they used to, so it may as well be me. Here on my own now after hours, here on my own now on a bus. Think of it this way, we could either be successful or be us. With our winning smiles and us, with our catchy tunes, oh us. No, I'm photogenic, you know, we don't stand a chance.
Is it weird? I didn't think about it like that in a way that it's kind of going back to songs that are of a certain time or a certain age that they could possibly be difficult to go back to.
Oh, not so much the songs, because we still play that song, for instance, a lot. It's more the recording.
You can't even bear to name it. You can even bear to name it. You call it that song.
This song that shall not be named.
But it's more the actual recording, because you feel that you can do it a bit better. You know, we had only been a band for about 6 months at that point.
What do you like about when your music's used in films? Because, you know, it would take me a long time to name all the films that Belle and Sebastian's music has featured in. And for you, what's the kind of, you know, I'm sure there's some you said no to.
Yeah, is my wife here? Did she make it? Oh, she didn't make it. Well, that's quite good because she's cringes every
time. She's out with a band, Stuart.
Having a good time somewhere. No, because every time somebody mentions Shrek, she... Because that sort of bloody-minded sort of... You know, back in the day, we didn't do music for films. We just used to say no to everything. You know, we'd got shown the script, you know, about this green monster, and we were like, come on, you know.
Get out my swamp!
So,
What changed that then? Was there, what changed you from just saying no to everything to going, we should think about this, guys?
I can't remember. It was maybe just one time where we got, the first thing we said yes to was because somebody phoned us up. It was actually Christina Ricci was making a film. And she got my home phone number, and and she phoned me up. It was Christina Ricci, and
did you go?
Because she knew that she wasn't getting anywhere. Because we just I said yes, whatever you want. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't about money or anything like that. She just asked. She was just nice, you know. So, and from that point onwards, we started to, you know, because it always there should be a connection.
Yeah.
You know, if there's a connection, it always has to come from the director or somebody creative. And if there's a connection, then usually the music use will be good. I mean, even in the one with John Cusack, High Fidelity, the music was Stevie's song, and it was used as the butt of a joke, but it was still probably the best use of it was really suitable, you know, and it was fun, you know. It was that was about the best use of our music in a film, I think.
Until now.
Have you ever been watching a film and your music's been in and you've not realised that it was going to be in it?
Maybe a couple of times, or sometimes randomly on TV or something. Yeah,
that's weird.
Yeah.
Did you speak to Simon as well, being a filmmaker yourself as well, in terms of that experience and, you know, and you know, I guess as a first-time full-length feature director, you are learning as well. You can prepare as much as you want, but you are still learning as you're going through that experience. And was that something you talked about in terms of what it is like to step into that role of making your first film?
I had a feeling for a second, I'd be like, you know, put him on my knee and try to explain things to him. And then, you know, very quickly, I got this feeling, listen, this is not my first picnic. Because, you know, he's been on sets, obviously, you know, when you've been on a set, and when you're actually a director, even if you're a seasoned director, sometimes directors are only on set for a very short period compared to the rest of the crew and the actors. And when you were saying your experience of being director, you were quite well prepared. I mean, I felt like I'd walked into a Gordon Ramsay's kitchen and then somebody said to me, okay, where's the menu? You know, like you're the chef or something. I didn't have a clue. I really was crapping it the first day. So I didn't have anything to offer.
The moments in Days of Bagnall Summer where you do kind of jump into Earl's or Daniel's kind of, you know, sonic world with that metal is used so brilliantly and kind of as bursts almost. Was that kind of navigating the kind of journey of the music in a way that where you would have it, where you wouldn't have it, both in terms of using Bell and Sebastian's music? Was that an easy thing to navigate?
It was definitely like we sort of figured it out as we went along. That sort of all came in the edit. So I think there was a first cut of the film. I mean, I really just wanted it to be like tonally consistent. So originally we didn't have any metal in there at all. It was all Bernd and Sebastian. And I don't know, I felt like it was missing it. Seems like such a easy joke in a way, like we'd be missing a trick not to have thrash metal over beautiful suburbs. And more importantly, that it was like you say, just a way into Daniel's head.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, we have that moment for Sue with Can't Smile Without You, and that we needed an equivalent for Daniel. So yeah, it was definitely not in the original plan, but it quickly became obvious that it probably helped.
I've got a couple of examples of it here. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, it just those moments felt very useful, just to avoid people feeling like, oh, we've seen this film before and we know what to expect. Just to have those sort of jolts of like, oh, yeah, you know, just wake up.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how people are able to do that kind of...
The guttural.
Yeah,
go on, give it a go.
just no, I just cough like for days. I have tried it, but you just cough for days. I think one of my favourite lines in the film is "Life's too short to spend with dickheads." I want a T-shirt with that on it. It's so good. But when you were with those tracks, I guess it was a case of what ones can we afford?
Yeah.
But also just we'd get that tone right as well, of it not being a total piss take, but it just landing right.
Like Earl did, I had to, you know, get my heavy metal on. I had to, so that was, you know, I spent a good few weeks. I mean, I do not, you might not be able to tell, but I don't have a background in metal.
Really?
But I was sort of into it by the end, to be honest. I feel like I think I cheated as well, because I think the stuff in there is slightly towards the slightly cooler end of metal. I didn't get into like Metallica, but I didn't mind like the noise stuff, just the sort of shouting and the screaming. I tapped into it.
It's just so clever the way that it's used. But one thing I think that's really interesting is knowing when to not use music.
Yeah.
Was that an easy thing to do? Because it kind of sounds like a stupid thing going, well, of course you know when to not. But it's quite a tricky thing, isn't it?
Totally. And I think that's like, that's what I was saying earlier about the not really scoring scenes.
Mm.
I just knew instinctively going in, I didn't want to do that. And I think a lot of the films that I like and a lot of sort of, I like a lot of pretentious European dogma cinema where there is just no music and like you're not led at all. And that feels very sort of truthful and honest to me, and much more in keeping with the book as well, which isn't, there's nothing extraneous about the book. It's so economical and sparse and so focused on those characters. So yeah, it felt important to give them space and to just feel the quiet in the house and that sort of distance between them.
Tension.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned a couple of films, you know, in terms of being reference points for the music side of things, Harold and Maude and The Graduate, but as a director and the aesthetic of the film and the tone of the film, did you have any specific reference film?
Well, references? Similar things, to be honest. I think a lot of the films that I love are from that era. I love all of Elaine May's films, like The Heartbreak Kid and Peter Bogdanovich, like The Paper Moon. And so a lot of those films that are quite restrained in the way they're shot, I guess,
mm-hmm.
but are still managed to be really funny.
Mm-hmm.
So I had those in my head, but also just because of the genre of this, there's a lot of overlap with like American indie films, you know, like Dazed and Confused and Rushmore and those sort of coming of agey.
Yeah, Virgin Suicides was.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, she's amazing, Sofia Coppola, and how she uses music as well. The music is so varied, but it all sort of seems to work together.
Stuart, for you, in terms of when you were going and taking that step into making your debut feature, and what for you aesthetically it was going to look like, Belle and Sebastian are a band who, they have such a strong aesthetic with them. You know, they are almost like a filmic band in a way, in terms of the imagery that you conjure up in the music that you make. But with God Help the Girl, were there specifics for you that were inspirations and reference points?
I guess there were. It was seems a long time ago now. Yeah, it seems a long time ago. It was 2012 we shot it.
Oh, but wow.
I do remember one thing, going into film four, pitching the film. I'd never pitched anything before in my life, and I was like, okay, it's going to be like a Belle and Sebastian record cover come to life. They were just like totally, completely unimpressed. It was a really short meeting. So it wasn't enough that it was just like a Belle and Sebastian aesthetic. But I like some musicals. I like pop musicals and good musicals where the music is good. I know that sounds funny, but I just, you know, like, for instance, The Sound of Music is full of amazing songs. You know, you can't deny them. They're mm-hmm. all good. Whereas some of the stuff my mum used to watch, like Carousel and South Pacific and Oklahoma, they didn't really do it for me, you know, so.
Calamity Jane?
Calamity Jane had got a couple of great ones. Yeah, yeah.
I've got a clip from God Help the Girl, if you don't mind. Oh. Us showing that, if that's all right.
Long leg girl from the west, you came onto the scene like an energetic beam. Charming
ways you have learnt, all the boys have been bent by your mesmerizing gaze. Waltzing into situations vacant, getting a raise. Writing home to tell your folks about the city ways are nagging at you. What's a girl supposed to do when a city closes in? Noise from the lady upstairs, she's as deaf as a post, as transparent as a race. Boys are queuing, trouble's brewing, but you take it all in.
But you take it all in.
Ride the wave of their affection, look behind the gaze and confessions of lust. Pretty even the top, please allow me to scrub, please allow me to rub, please allow me to scrub.
So good.
Similar kind of bath vibe there, wasn't it?
Yeah,
we didn't plan that.
Did you know about Ollie at the time in terms of what his kind of aspirate? I mean, I don't know if at the time he was, you know, years and years was even something that was.
Yeah, it wasn't. He just auditioned, and I saw hundreds of people, and I saw a Skype audition. And he was like, usually everybody was like, you know, playing guitar and stuff. And he was standing behind a funny keyboard going, "Hi, I'm going to play one of my own songs." And I was like, "Oh, wow, this is unique." So I cast him within seconds. You know,
amazing.
He was obviously. And then actually during the filming, he was asking my advice. He was saying my agent wants me to give up film and do like try pop music for a while. I was going, "What are you talking about?" It was clear by this time he was a genius, and I said, "No, you can do both." He says, "No, I think I'm going to try pop for a while," and obviously 6 months later he won the BBC award something, and then he was off.
He's an extraordinary front man.
Yeah,
so amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah, incredible. It was so nice to revisit that film, and I know I spoke to you at the time about it, but you know, the music having such a specific role within that, of it being part of the narrative, you know, which is quite a unique thing. And when you're casting that, you have to get those castings spot on. And Emily as well, it was like, it was just kind of beautiful synergy with that. Was that an easy thing? You know, you talk about you saw thousands of people for Ollie Joel, but with Emily, was she something? And I know you kind of fought against having someone that was known. Is that right?
No, not really. I would have taken anybody that was... I was saying anybody that was right for the part. It was
it was
the hardest artistic choice. It was almost as hard as getting married or something like that. It was really, I didn't really make a choice. Obviously, we just got married, but it's probably a good job my wife isn't here.
She's not here. We're fine.
I'm kind of glad she's here, but she knows. I mean, Marissa would tell you casting is. I think it's because I didn't know. Because it was my first time.
Yeah.
I think everything that I would do would be much quicker. You know, it was just the hardest thing. But then again, Ollie was, when the right thing appears.
That's it. I think it does, like, casting's horrible for the whole time until you find the right person. It doesn't seem possible that you will find the right person. Mm-hmm. So you have to, like, in your head, you're thinking, okay, well, this person's good enough, I think. And, like, you sort of accept that, mm-hmm. and then the right person walks in and is like, oh no, this is okay, fine, everything's fine.
I mean Monica in your film is just, she's so great.
Yeah, she's perfect. Oh, she didn't have to audition though.
No,
I always had my eye on her for that, because I've seen her in so much stuff, and I knew she'd be perfect for it.
Did you just send her the script and she kind of was like, yep?
Yeah, it was slightly more complicated. but yeah, there were a couple of meetings. She's just such a like pro that she was more about her scoping me out than me scoping her out, I think. But yeah, we had a couple of meetings in a cafe in Foyles, and after that it was a yes.
Has the experience of making your first film made you want to make another one?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I loved it, and I'm really proud of it. But at the same time, there's like things about it that I would do differently. So yeah, I just want to have the opportunity to go and do another one.
You brought a couple of clips of some of your. Well, what are they? Your favourite bits of music in film?
I just brought a couple of random clips. And how about you play the Black Klansman?
Yeah.
Have you got that one?
Got it here.
I just, as an example of the way that you hope your music would be used someday in a film.
Okay, let's have a look.
Let's dance. Follow me. Come on.
Turn back now.
Of course, you got to write a song. It's, you know, you got to make a record as good as that. But it's just the notion of that you could be sitting in a cinema and you get the scene where everybody's just having the best time. Yeah. You know,
everyone's singing along. Everyone knows the words.
Yeah.
Wants to do the dance.
Yeah.
That idea of a piece of diegetic music, though, where it's in film, you know, as a piece of music. And I imagine someone like Spike can pretty much use anything, I would imagine.
He's probably my favorite person for using, you know, the range of things that he does, the way that he uses music, because his dad used to do his scores early on, and they were jazzy. It was and they're fantastic. Like, the, for instance, the Do the Right Thing, not Do the Right Thing, what's the one I've got on there? Oh, She's Got a Habit from 86 is probably my favorite score.
Never wastes music.
Yeah, no, it's perfect.
Every kind of sort of note kind of means something, I think, is in the way that he uses it. Right, one more. Which one?
Oh, do I get one more?
You get one more.
Oh, this is fab. Zootopia, since all we ever watch is kids' movies now, but here's a great one.
Nobody learns without getting.
Is that Shakira?
Shakira, yeah. Sorry, Zootropolis is the movie, not Zootropolis.
Scene is very good. The animation, that's amazing. The worlds they create are just absolutely extraordinary.
It's brilliant, yeah.
What do you like about it?
Well, that was just the feeling of it. I think that's a... It's a common thing in a film where a kind of young person comes to the city for the first time. In this case, it happens to be young Rabbit. But I think you get that feeling anyway. You know, it could be Ferris Bueller or something like that when they're driving into Chicago or you know, something. But it's just, it gets, you know, I was surprised when I was watching this. I was getting that same exhilaration. Wow, look at the city. and that Shakira tune's amazing.
Yeah.
Great tune.
It's so great to hear how your music's been used in Simon's film, because so much of the minute you get that kind of, oh, so-and-so's done a, you know, has done a track, has done something on the soundtrack, and you kind of watch the entire film and then it's just over the end credits. And it's like such a waste of or it's also just a marketing tool for things as well. But to see, you know, a band really invest in a story and supply a new filmmaker with so much music is a wonderful thing and a wonderful support to see from kind of two different sides of art, I guess, as well.
It's definitely worth it. Sorry, so I just, it's thrilling for us, honestly.
I was just going to say thank you, basically.
No. It's thrilling to get the chance because you're right. I've seen on a few occasions, you know, you've got to see something, maybe your own music's been in it or somebody else's music and it just pops up at the end. You're like, what's the point of that?
And we've got time for about 5-10 minutes of questions if anybody would like the opportunity to ask Stuart or Simon any questions. We've got some Roman microphones. And also, I always find when I do these things that once one person asks a question,
yeah,
it's like Pringles, once you pop, you can't stop. So that first person, you know, kind of don't be scared.
Yes, we've got one.
Yes. Hello.
You're a hero.
I just wondered, the scenes that you shot at the seaside, was that an amalgam of many different locations?
It was, well spotted, yeah. We shot it the bulk of it in Southend. You guys came to visit, actually, when we were...
Had a lovely day in Southend.
Yeah. and then there are other bits in Dungeness and various other places I now can't remember.
How long was the shoot?
It was 4 weeks, yeah, so it was busy.
Yeah, wow. Any other questions from lady down the front here, please? And then a man over there.
You said you had masses of really great songs to choose from. Once you'd done all your kind of filming and you were in that stage where you were putting the film together,
yeah,
was that when you started to connect the film, the sound, to the music to the images? Or had you been doing that all the way through when you were... Because you had the music really early.
Yeah.
Were you doing it as you made the film? Or was it at the end that you started to...
It was the end, really, that I started, like, putting it on specific scenes. But definitely having it early was really helpful in that I knew there were definitely, like, bits of the music that I wanted to use or that I felt were going to be right for certain sections. But the actual, like, yeah, pasting it on didn't happen till later.
Was it really hard to choose from all
Oh, yeah, it was horrible.
What are you going to do with the extra ones?
Destroyed.
What are you going to do with the extra ones?
Oh, we always recycle, you know. It's like they pop up, then, but yeah.
Gentleman over here, hello.
Can I ask how much the film cost to make and how you funded it?
Yeah, it was, I think it was just under $500,000. And it's independent film financing is just a horrible world. And some of the money came from the company that are distributing the film, Altitude, who gave us some money up front, which was very kind of them. And then we just raised various bits of money from various other, some literally just in some individuals and some organizations. But it's very, very stressful, that process, because it's all like a jigsaw puzzle. And if one piece goes, then all the others get spooked and leave as well. So you don't know it's happening until the day. Also, they won't send you the money until you're literally starting filming. So you have to tell everyone. I just had to pretend to Stuart the film is definitely happening. And to all the cast and all the crew as well. I'd be like, oh, yeah, no, it's definitely happening.
they have to see you there Monday morning. But they don't actually like send the money to the producer's account till you start. So it's very, that was definitely the worst bit.
It's not a lot of money as well for a beautiful film as well. I mean, I'm really shocked at how...
Yeah, Baroness Bastion, I think probably for them, did it at a very cut price deal. So I massively appreciate that. Yeah, the on the music front, you know, all the metal we use, all of it costs money. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, the metal bands, I think, were just surprised to be asked. So they gave it to us pretty cheap. But there was one, we had to have a song at the end. There's a wedding at the end and they danced to...
Oh, God, yeah.
And we needed that song to be a sort of feel like a classic wedding song. So it had to be something recognisable. And we used this Scissor Sisters song in the end. And
for like dancing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was very, that's where the majority of the music budget went, to be honest. For a long time, it didn't seem like we'd get that, but they sort of eventually gave us a deal as well. As Stuart said earlier, a lot of it is just about trying to make a connection with them and mm-hmm. just begging, just please.
Yeah.
Crying.
Yeah, so related to the kids' table at the wedding as well.
Yeah.
I was always on that table for longer than I should have been as a child. So good. Sorry, that was just a personal share there. Ah, right. Anyone else? Hello, mate. I've got a question. Thank you.
One question each. First of all, Stuart, does the success of Shrek leave you lying awake at night?
No. No.
Yes.
No. No, you kind of live in the now, you know, you just...
And your next question?
Simon, did holding an audition process just seem like such a juxtaposition to, like, auditioning yourself, like, bringing back in memories of, like, auditioning for the Inbetweeners or something?
Yeah, I mean, I've been quite lucky in that. I've never really... audition for stuff with the Inbetweeners. I was just friends with Ian and Damon, who wrote it. I used to write sketches for them for their radio show, and I kept asking if I could audition for the Inbetweeners, and they kept saying no, that I was far too old, and I think, to quote them, far too camp. They just ran out of time and they had my phone number. So, and then Friday Night Dinner, Robert, who writes Friday Night Dinner, was the editor on Inbetweeners. So he just asked me to be in it and when we were at Inbetweeners rehearsal. So I've never got a part that I've auditioned for. in a way, it brought back some horrible memories, putting all those kids through it. Yeah, I've forgotten the question now. I'm just remembering all my horrible auditions.
The kid who plays Daniel's friend, I've forgotten his character name.
Yeah, Kai.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he's great,
like,
isn't it?
Is he like Justin from the Darkness? He's like secret love child or something. Because he's just, he's
all,
amazing.
That's all real as well. That's funny what he's like. That's Elliot Spelagillet, who was he was the kid in Uncle, which is a BBC Three sitcom. And he's all grown up now. Yeah, he's an amazing character.
So good.
He's a proper old school eccentric in the greatest tradition.
Yeah,
he's lovely.
Yeah, it's great. Okay, we've got any more questions? Yep. over there. We've got one each side, and then that's, I think, all we've got time. So thank you.
Hi, guys. Yeah, I love the film. It was excellent. Really, really funny. I was just wondering, did you not fancy having a cameo role in it at all?
Oh, God. No, you're asking Stuart.
No,
absolutely not, no. I think I was just desperately wanted to direct and really wanted to do as good a job as I could. And so there were so many... What was amazing about it was getting to cast all those brilliant people, you know, like Tim Key and Alice Lowe and Tamsin Gregg and Rob Brydon and all those cameos. So no, I always thought there are better people for those parts than me. And that's the joy of directing, is getting to cast just people that you're huge fans of and work with people that you're huge fans of.
Did you find it easy directing people?
I did, yeah. I might have just been lucky, and you obviously hear like horror stories of actors who it's impossible to direct, but everyone that was in this was really nice, and I sort of half knew all of them anyway, so it'd been weird if they'd been really horrible to me. So no, I was lucky.
And then we had one last question over here.
Hello, do you both have a favourite score and soundtrack?
Oh God, can you go first?
Well, I did mention the Spike Lee one that we saw.
Oh, yeah, I said that, yeah.
She's got to have it.
But you said Harold and Maude earlier. I like that as well.
Yeah.
Can I steal that?
Yeah.
And then we're done.
The sun, wine for the woman who made the rain come. Seagulls sing your hearts away as wild sinners sin, the children play. Oh Lord, how they play and play for that happy day, for that happy day.
Yeah, do you have anything else?
There's a funny Ealing comedy called Two Way Stretch with Peter Sellers, and it's probably the last one you thought I would say, but check it out. The music's terrific. It's a really good one.
Prepared for this. We're on a podcast called Soundtracking. It's the most obvious, no offense to you, but it's a really obvious question, and I didn't see it coming. I'm gonna have to comment on this episode and
it's fine.
I'll come back to
we'll come back to you, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll give you, okay, yeah. At the airport I'll ask you and see what it says. Thank you so much for coming and doing this.
Don't be ridiculous. Thank you for having us. That's been amazing.
The next film in sight, in thought, in...
It's in thought, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It just takes such a long time. Mm. So, yeah, in 2025, yeah. Maybe. But, I mean, seriously, don't laugh. That's my old bit. Yeah.
Stuart, what about you? You going to make another film?
Yeah, one day. One day we're, you know, the group's been on a tear since we last did the film. I haven't really had any time off, and maybe one day, but then I'll probably do something with the group next time.
Yeah, and I can't not ask you what Belle and Sebastian are up to for all the fans in the room.
We're just you know, what do bands do? We record and then go on tour and record and go on tour. So yeah, we're making another record as we speak,
which fantastic. Is fantastic. Yeah. Amazing. I love that little ripple of like energy in the room as well. Thank you so much, both of you, for being here. Thank you so much, guys, as well, for coming out and joining us, and to Glasgow Film Festival as well for having us back for Soundtrack. And enjoy the rest of your weekend. Thank you so much. Huge round of applause, please.
Thank you, guys.
Stuart and Simon. You. Thank you, guys. Thanks. When the wind blows, I love my tree in autumn, like I love my tree in summer, like I love my tree in winter. They put me in a room and I thought of you in autumn, and I'm sad I won't see you again. Pretty when you sing
from his film God Help the Girl That's Pretty When the Wind Blows by Stuart Murdoch, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Stuart and Simon Bird. A huge thanks to both gentlemen for taking the time to join us in front of an audience at the Glasgow Film Festival. Days of the Bagnold Summer is available on home entertainment formats now, with Bell and Sebastian's wonderful collection of songs that feature in the movie out via Matador on all the usual platforms. And we'll put up a Spotify playlist for this show at edithbowman.com. My website is also the place to subscribe and catch up with all of our previous episodes. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And do look up our YouTube channel, where I post a weekly show with guests from the world of film, TV and music. Next up, it's only our 200th episode. What? And we celebrate that in the wonderful company of female composer Pina Toprak, who does fantastic work across many mediums, be that working on Fortnite in the gaming world or Captain Marvel in the film world. So I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then. In the meantime, stay safe and look after each other.